He is an idiot Ecclesiastes, I said to myself. And in this phrase, my two visions of her, as idiot and as symbolist, met, collided, and fused. She had done appallingly in the testing, which in a sense was designed, like all neurological and psychological testing, not merely to uncover, to bring out deficits, but to decompose her into functions and deficits. She had come apart horribly in formal testing, but now she was mysteriously together and composed. Why was she so decomposed before? How could she be so recomposed now? I had the strongest feeling of two wholly different modes of thought, or of organization, or of being. The first, schematic. Pattern-seeing, problem-solving. This is what had been tested, and where she'd been found so defective, so disastrously wanting. But the tests had given no inkling of anything but the deficits, of anything, so to speak, beyond her deficits. They had given me no hint of her positive powers, her ability to perceive the real world, the world of nature, and perhaps of the imagination, as a coherent, intelligible, poetic whole. Her ability to see this, think this, and, when she could, live this. They had given me no intimation of her inner world, which clearly was composed and coherent, an approach to something other than a set of problems or tasks. But what was the composing principle which could allow her composure? Clearly it was something other than schematic. I found myself thinking of her fondness for tales, for narrative composition and coherence. Is it possible, I wondered, that this being before me, at once a charming girl and a moron, a cognitive mishap, can use a narrative or dramatic mode to compose and integrate a coherent world, in place of the schematic mode, which in her is so defective that it simply doesn't work? And as I thought, I remembered her dancing, and how this could organize her otherwise ill-knit and clumsy movements. Our tests, our approaches, I thought, as I watched her on the bench, enjoying not just a simple but a sacred view of nature, our approach, our evaluations are ridiculously inadequate. They only show us deficits. They do not show us powers. They only show us puzzles and schemata, when we need to see music, narrative, play, a being conducting itself spontaneously in its own natural way. Rebecca, I felt, was complete and intact as narrative being, in conditions which allowed her to organize herself in a narrative way. And this was something very important to know, for it allowed one to see her and her potential in a quite different fashion from that imposed by the schematic mode. It was perhaps fortunate that I chanced to see Rebecca in her so different modes, so damaged and incorrigible in the one, so full of promise and potential in the other, and that she was one of the first patients I saw in our clinic. For what I saw in her, what she showed me, I now saw in them all. As I continued to see her, she seemed to deepen. Or perhaps, she revealed, or I came to respect her depths more and more. They were not wholly happy depths, no depths ever are, but they were predominantly happy for the greater part of the year. Then in November her grandmother died, and the light, the joy she had expressed in April, now turned into the deepest grief and darkness. She was devastated, but conducted herself with great dignity. Dignity, ethical depth, was added at this time to form a grave and lasting counterpoint to the light lyrical self I had especially seen before. I called on her as soon as I heard the news, and she received me with great dignity, but frozen with grief, in her small room in the now empty house. Her speech was again ejaculated, Jacksonian in brief utterances of grief and lamentation. "Why did she have to go?" she cried, and added, "I'm crying for me, not for her." Then, after an interval, Granny's all right. She's gone to her long home. Long home. Was this her own symbol, or an unconscious memory of or allusion to Ecclesiastes? I'm so cold, she cried, huddling into herself. It's not outside, it's winter inside. Cold as death, she added. She was a part of me. Part of me died with her. She was complete in her mourning, tragic and complete. There was absolutely no sense of her being then a mental defective. After half an hour, she unfroze, regained some of her warmth and animation, said, It is winter. I feel dead. But I know the spring will come again. The work of grief was slow but successful, as Rebecca, even when most stricken, anticipated. It was greatly helped by a sympathetic and supportive great aunt, a sister of her granny, who now moved into the house. It was greatly helped by the synagogue and the religious community, above all by the rites of sitting Shiva, and the special status accorded her as the bereaved one, the chief mourner. It was helped, too, perhaps, by her speaking freely to me. And it was helped also, interestingly, by dreams which she related with animation and which clearly marked stages in the grief work. As I remember her, like Nina in the April Sun, so I remember her etched with tragic clearness in the dark November of that year, standing in a bleak cemetery in Queens, saying the Kaddish over her grandmother's grave. Prayers and Bible stories had always appealed to her, going with the happy, the lyrical, the blessing side of her life. Now, in the funeral prayers, in the 103rd Psalm, and above all in the Kaddish, she found the right and only words for her comfort and lamentation. During the intervening months, between my first seeing her in April and her grandmother's death that November, Rebecca, like all our clients, an odious word then becoming fashionable, supposedly less degrading than patients, was pressed into a variety of workshops and classes. As part of our developmental and cognitive drive, these two were in terms at the time. It didn't work with Rebecca. It didn't work with most of them. It was not, I came to think, the right thing to do, because what we did was to drive them full tilt upon their limitations, as had already been done futilely and often to the point of cruelty throughout their lives. We paid far too much attention to the defects of our patients, as Rebecca was the first to tell me, and far too little to what was intact or preserved. To use another piece of jargon, we were far too concerned with defectology and far too little with narratology, the neglected and needed science of the concrete. Rebecca made clear by concrete illustrations, by her own self, the two wholly different, wholly separate forms of thought and mind, paradigmatic and narrative, in Brunner's terminology. And though equally natural and native to the expanding human mind, the narrative comes first, has spiritual priority. Very young children love and demand stories and can understand complex matters presented as stories when their powers of comprehending general concepts, paradigms, are almost non-existent. It is this narrative or symbolic power which gives a sense of the world, a concrete reality in the imaginative form of symbol and story, when abstract thought can provide nothing at all. A child follows the Bible before he follows Euclid. Not because the Bible is simpler, the reverse might be said, but because it is cast in a symbolic and narrative mode. And in this way, Rebecca, at 19, was still, as her grandmother said, just like a child. Like a child, but not a child, because she was adult. The term retarded suggests a persisting child. the term mentally defective a defective adult. Both terms, both concepts, combine deep truth and falsity. With Rebecca and with other defectives allowed or encouraged in a personal development, the emotional and narrative and symbolic powers can develop strongly and exuberantly and may produce, as in Rebecca, a sort of natural poet, or, as in Jose, a sort of natural artist, while the paradigmatic or conceptual powers, manifestly feeble from the start, grind very slowly and painfully along, and are only capable of a very limited and stunted development. Rebecca realized this fully, as she had shown it to me so clearly, right from the very first day I saw her, when she spoke of her clumsiness, and of how her ill-composed and ill-organized movements became well-organized, composed, and fluent with music. And when she showed me how she herself was composed by a natural scene, a scene with an organic, aesthetic, and dramatic unity and sense. Rather suddenly, after her grandmother's death, she became clear and decisive. "I want no more classes, no more workshops," she said. "They do nothing for me. They do nothing to bring me together." And then, with that power for the apt model or metaphor I so admired, and which was so well developed in her, despite her low IQ, she looked down at the office carpet and said, "I'm like a sort of living carpet. I need a pattern, a design, like you have on that carpet. I come apart. I unravel unless there's a design." I looked down at the carpet as Rebecca said this, and found myself thinking of Sherrington's famous image, comparing the brain-mind to an enchanted loom, weaving patterns, ever dissolving, but always with meaning. I thought, can one have a raw carpet without a design? Could one have the design without the carpet? But this seemed like the smile without the Cheshire cat. A living carpet, as Rebecca was, had to have both. And she especially, with her lack of schematic structure, the warp and woof, the knit of the carpet, so to speak, might indeed unravel without a design, the scenic or narrative structure of the carpet. "I must have meaning," she went on. "The classes, the odd jobs have no meaning. What I really love," she added wistfully, "is the theater." We removed Rebecca from the workshop she hated and managed to enroll her in a special theater group. She loved this. It composed her. She did amazingly well. She became a complete person, poised, fluent, with style in each role. And now if one sees Rebecca on stage, for theater and the theater group soon became her life, one would never even guess that she was mentally defective. Postscript. The power of music, narrative, and drama is of the greatest practical and theoretical importance. One may see this even in the case of idiots with IQs below 20 and the extremist motor incompetence and bewilderment. Their uncouth movements may disappear in a moment with music and dancing. Suddenly, with music, they know how to move. We see how the retarded, unable to perform fairly simple tasks involving perhaps 4 or 5 movements or procedures in sequence, can do these perfectly if they work to music. The sequence of movements they cannot hold as schemes being perfectly holdable as music, that is, embedded in music. The same may be seen very dramatically in patients with severe frontal lobe damage and apraxia, an inability to do things, to retain the simplest motor sequences and programs, even to walk, despite perfectly preserved intelligence in all other ways. This procedural defect, or motor idiocy, as one might call it, which completely defeats any ordinary system of rehabilitative instruction, vanishes at once if music is the instructor. All this, no doubt, is the rationale, or one of the rationales, of work songs. What we see fundamentally is the power of music to organize, and to do this efficaciously as well as joyfully, when abstract or schematic forms of organization fail. Indeed, it is especially dramatic, as one would expect, precisely when no other form of organization will work. Thus, music, or any other form of narrative, is essential when working with the retarded or apraxic. Schooling or therapy for them must be centered on music or something equivalent. And in drama, there is still more. There is the power of role, to give organization, to confer, while it lasts, an entire personality. The capacity to perform, to play, to be, seems to be a given in human life, in a way which has nothing to do with intellectual differences. One sees this with infants, one sees it with the senile, and one sees it, most poignantly, with the Rebeccas of this world. Chapter 22. A Walking Grove. Martin A., aged 61, was admitted to our home towards the end of 1983, having become Parkinsonian and unable to look after himself any longer. He had had a nearly fatal meningitis in infancy, which caused retardation, impulsiveness, seizures, and some spasticity on one side. He had very limited schooling, but a remarkable musical education. His father was a famous singer at the Met. He lived with his parents until their death, and thereafter eked out a marginal living as a messenger, a porter, and a short-order cook. Whatever he could do before he was fired, as he invariably was, because of his slowness, dreaminess, or incompetence, it would have been a dull and disheartening life had it not been for his remarkable musical gifts and sensibilities, and the joy this brought him and others. He had an amazing musical memory. I know more than 2,000 operas, he told me on one occasion, although he had never learned or been able to read music. Whether this would have been possible or not was not clear. He had always depended on his extraordinary ear, his power to retain an opera or an oratorio after a single hearing. Unfortunately, his voice was not up to his ear, being tuneful but gruff with some spastic dysphonia. His innate hereditary musical gift had clearly survived the ravages of meningitis and brain damage. Or had it? Would he have been a Caruso if undamaged? Or was his musical development, to some extent, a compensation for brain damage and intellectual limitations? We shall never know. What is certain is that his father transmitted not only his musical genes, but his own great love for music, in the intimacy of a father-son relationship, and perhaps the specially tender relation of a parent to a retarded child. Martin, slow, clumsy, was loved by his father, and passionately loved him in return. And their love was cemented by their shared love for music. The great sorrow of Martin's life was that he could not follow his father and be a famous opera and oratorio singer like him. But this was not an obsession, and he found and gave much pleasure with what he could do. He was consulted, even by the famous, for his remarkable memory, which extended beyond the music itself to all the details of performance. He enjoyed a modest fame as a walking encyclopedia, who knew not only the music of 2,000 operas, but all the singers who had taken the roles in countless performances, and all the details of scenery, staging, dress, and decor. He also prided himself on a street-by-street, house-by-house knowledge of New York, and knowing the routes of all its buses and trains. Thus, he was an opera buff, and something of an idiot savant, too. He took a certain childlike pleasure in all this, the pleasure of such eidetics and freaks. But the real joy, and the only thing that made life supportable, was actual participation in musical events, singing in the choirs at local churches. He could not sing solo, to his grief, because of his dysphonia, especially in the grand events at Easter and Christmas, the John and Matthew Passions, the Christmas Oratorio, The Messiah, which he had done for 50 years, boy and man, in the great churches and cathedrals of the city. He had also sung at the Met, and, when it was pulled down, at Lincoln Center, discreetly concealed amid the vast choruses of Wagner and Verdi. At such times, in the oratorios and passions most of all, but also in the humbler church choirs and chorales, as he soared up into the music, Martin forgot that he was retarded, forgot all the sadness and badness of his life, sensed a great spaciousness enfold him, felt himself both a true man and a true child of God. Martin's world, his inner world. What sort of a world did he have? He had very little knowledge of the world at large, at least very little living knowledge, and no interest at all. If a page of an encyclopedia or newspaper was read to him, or a map of Asia's rivers or New York subway shown to him, it was recorded instantly in his eidetic memory. But he had no relation to these eidetic recordings. They were acentric, to use Richard Wolheim's term, without him, without anyone or anything as a living center. There seemed little or no emotion in such memories, no more emotion than there is in a street map of New York, nor did they connect or ramify or get generalized in any way. Thus his eidetic memory, the freak part of him, did not in itself form or convey any sense of a world. It was without unity, without feeling, without relation to himself. It was physiological, one felt, like a memory core or memory bank, but not part of a real and personal living self. And yet, even here, there was a single and striking exception, at once his most prodigious, most personal, and most pious deed of memory. He knew by heart Grove's Dictionary of Music and Musicians, the immense 9-volume edition published in 1954. Indeed, he was a walking Grove. His father was aging and somewhat ailing by then, could no longer sing actively, but spent most of his time at home, playing his great collection of vocal records on the phonograph, going through and singing all his scores, which he did with his now 30-year-old son in the closest and most affectionate communion of their lives, and reading aloud Grove's Dictionary, all 6,000 pages of it, which, as he read, was indelibly printed upon his son's limitlessly retentive, if illiterate, cortex. Grove, thereafter, was heard in his father's voice, and could never be recollected by him without emotion. Such prodigious hypertrophies of eidetic memory, especially if employed or exploited professionally, sometimes seem to oust the real self, or to compete with it, and impede its development. And if there is no depth, no feeling, there is also no pain in such memories, and so they can serve as an escape from reality. This clearly occurred to a great extent in Luria's Mnemonist, and is poignantly described in the last chapter of his book. It obviously occurred to some extent in Martin, but was also used for reality, even super-reality, an exceptional, intense, and mystical sense of the world. Eidetics apart, what of his world generally? It was, in many respects, small, petty, nasty, and dark. The world of a retarded who had been teased and left out as a child and then hired and fired contemptuously from menial jobs as a man. The world of someone who had rarely felt himself or felt regarded as a proper child or man. He was often childish, sometimes spiteful, and prone to sudden tantrums. And the language he then used was that of a child. "I'll throw a mud pie in your face," I once heard him scream, and occasionally he spat or struck out. He sniffed. He was dirty. He blew snot on his sleeve. He had the look, and doubtless the feelings at such times, of a small, snotty child. These childish characteristics, topped off by his irritating, eidetic showing off, endeared him to nobody. He soon became unpopular in the home and found himself shunned by many of the residents. A crisis was developing, with Martin regressing weekly and daily, and nobody was quite sure at first what to do. It was at first put down to adjustment difficulties, such as all patients may experience on giving up independent living outside and coming into a home. But Sister felt there was something more specific at work, something gnawing at him, a sort of hunger, a gnawing hunger we can't assuage. It's destroying him, she continued. We have to do something. So in January, for the second time, I went to see Martin and found a very different man. No longer cocky, showing off as before, but obviously pining in spiritual and a sort of physical pain. What is it? I said. What is the matter?
I've got to sing, he said hoarsely. I can't live without it. And it's not just music. I can't pray without it.
And then suddenly, with a flash of his old memory,
music to Bach was the apparatus of worship. Grove article on Bach, page 304. I've never spent a Sunday, he continued, more gently, reflectively, without going to church, without singing in the choir. I first went there with my father when I was old enough to walk, and I continued going after his death in 1955. I've got to go, he said fiercely. It'll kill me if I don't.
And go you shall, I said. We didn't know what you were missing. The church was not far from the home, and Martin was welcomed back, not only as a faithful member of the congregation and the choir, but as the brains and advisor of the choir that his father had been before him. With this, life suddenly and dramatically changed. Martin had resumed his proper place as he felt it. He could sing, he could worship in Bach's music every Sunday, and also enjoy the quiet authority that was accorded him.
You see, he told me on my next visit, without cockiness, but as a simple matter of fact, they know I know all Bach's liturgical and choral music. I know all the church cantatas, all 202 that Grove lists, and which Sundays and holy days they should be sung on. We are the only church in the diocese with a real orchestra and choir, the only one where all of Bach's vocal works are regularly sung. We do a cantata every Sunday, and we are going to do the Matthew Passion this Easter.
I thought it curious and moving that Martin, a retarded, should have this great passion for Bach. Bach seemed so intellectual, and Martin was a simpleton. What I did not realize until I started bringing in cassettes of the cantatas, and once of the Magnificat, when I visited, was that for all his intellectual limitations, Martin's musical intelligence was fully up to appreciating much of the technical complexity of Bach. But more than this, that it wasn't a question of intelligence at all. Bach lived for him, and he lived in Bach. Martin did indeed have freak musical abilities, but they were only freak-like if removed from their right and natural context. What was central to Martin, as it had been central for his father, and what had been intimately shared between them, was always the spirit of music, especially religious music, and of the voice as the divine instrument, made and ordained to sing, to raise itself in jubilation and praise. Martin became a different man then, when he returned to song and church. Recovered himself, recollected himself, became real again. The pseudo-persons, the stigmatized retarded, the snotty spitting boy, disappeared. As did the irritating, emotionless, impersonal eidetic.
the real person reappeared, a dignified, decent man, respected and valued now by the other residents. But the marvel, the real marvel, was to see Martin when he was actually singing, or in communion with music, listening with an intentness which verged on rapture, a man in his wholeness, wholly attending. At such times, Martin was, in a word, transformed. All that was defective or pathological fell away, and one saw only absorption and animation, wholeness and health. Postscript. When I wrote this piece and the two succeeding ones, I wrote solely out of my own experience, with almost no knowledge of the literature on the subject, indeed with no knowledge that there was a large literature. I only got an inkling of it, often baffling and intriguing, after the next chapter, The Twins, was first published, when I found myself inundated with letters and off-prints. In particular, my attention was drawn to a beautiful and detailed 1970 case study by David Viscott. There are many similarities between Martin and his patient, Harriet G. In both cases, there were extraordinary powers, which were sometimes used in an eccentric or life-denying way, sometimes in a life-affirming and creative way. Thus, after her father had read it to her, Harriet retained the first three pages of the Boston telephone directory, and for several years could give any number on these pages on request. But in a wholly different and strikingly creative mode, she could compose and improvise in the style of any composer. It is clear that both, like the twins in the next chapter, could be pushed or drawn into the sort of mechanical feats considered typical of idiot savants, feats at once prodigious and meaningless, but that both, also like the twins, when not pushed or drawn in this fashion, showed a consistent seeking after beauty and order. Though Martin has an amazing memory for random, meaningless facts, his real pleasure comes from order and coherence. Whether it be the musical and spiritual order of a cantata, or the encyclopedic order of Grove. Both Bach and Grove communicate a world. Martin, indeed, has no world but music, as is the case with Viscott's patient. But this world is a real world, makes him real, can transform him. This is marvelous to see with Martin, and it was evidently no less so with Harriet G. This ungainly, awkward, inelegant lady, this overgrown five-year-old, became absolutely transformed when I asked her to perform for a seminar at Boston State Hospital. She sat down demurely, stared quietly at the keyboard until we all grew silent, and brought her hands slowly to the keyboard and let them rest a moment. Then she nodded her head and began to play with all the feeling and movement of a concert performer. From that moment, she was another person. One speaks of idiot savants as if they had an odd knack or talent of a mechanical sort, with no real intelligence or understanding. This, indeed, was what I first thought with Martin, and continued to think until I brought in the Magnificat. Only then did it finally become clear to me that Martin could grasp the full complexity of such a work, and that it was not just a knack or a remarkable rote memory at work, but a genuine and powerful musical intelligence. I was particularly interested, therefore, after this book was first published, to receive a fascinating article by L.K. Miller of Chicago, entitled Sensitivity to Tonal Structure in a Developmentally Disabled Musical Savant, presented at the Psychonomic Society, Boston, November 1985. Meticulous study of this five-year-old prodigy, with severe mental and other handicaps due to maternal rubella, showed not rote memory of a mechanical sort, but impressive sensitivity to the rules governing composition, particularly the role of different notes in determining diatonic key structure, implying implicit knowledge of structural rules in a generative sense, That is, rules not limited to the specific examples provided by one's experience. This, I am convinced, is the case with Martin, too. And one must wonder whether it may not be true of all idiot savants, that they may be truly and creatively intelligent, and not just have a mechanical knack in the specific realms, musical, numerical, visual, whatever, in which they excel. It is the intelligence of a Martin, albeit in a special and narrow area, that finally forces itself on one. And it is this intelligence that must be recognized and nurtured. Chapter 23. The Twins. When I first met the twins, John and Michael, in 1966 in a state hospital, they were already well known. They had been on radio and television, and made the subject of detailed scientific and popular reports. They had even, I suspected, found their way into science fiction, a little fictionalized, but essentially as portrayed in the accounts that had been published. The twins, who were then 26 years old, had been in institutions since the age of 7, variously diagnosed as autistic, psychotic, or severely retarded. Most of the accounts concluded that, as idiot savants go, there was nothing much to them, except for the remarkable documentary memories of the tiniest visual details of their own experience, and their use of an unconscious calendrical algorithm that enabled them to say at once on what day of the week a date far in the past or future would fall. This is the view taken by Stephen Smith in his comprehensive and imaginative book, The Great Mental Calculators. There have been, to my knowledge, no further studies of the twins since the mid-60s, the brief interest they aroused being quenched by the apparent solution of the problems they presented. But this, I believe, is a misapprehension, perhaps a natural enough one in view of the stereotyped approach, the fixed format of questions, the concentration on one task or another, with which the original investigators approached the twins, and by which they reduced them, their psychology, their methods, their lives, almost to nothing. The reality is far stranger, far more complex, far less explicable than any of these studies suggest. But it is not even to be glimpsed by aggressive formal testing or the usual 60 minutes-like interviewing of the twins. Not that any of these studies or TV performances is wrong. They are quite reasonable, often informative as far as they go, but they confine themselves to the obvious and testable surface and do not go to the depths, do not even hint or perhaps guess that there are depths below. One indeed gets no hint of any depths unless one ceases to test the twins, to regard them as subjects. One must lay aside the urge to limit and test and get to know the twins, observe them, openly, quietly, without presuppositions, but with a full and sympathetic phenomenological openness, as they live and think and interact quietly, pursuing their own lives spontaneously in their singular way. Then one finds there is something exceedingly mysterious at work, powers and depths of a perhaps fundamental sort, which I have not been able to solve in the 18 years that I have known them. They are, indeed, unprepossessing at first encounter, a sort of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, indistinguishable mirror images, identical in face, in body movements, in personality, in mind, identical, too, in their stigmata of brain and tissue damage. They are undersized, with disturbing disproportions in head and hands, high-arched palates, high-arched feet, monotonous, squeaky voices, a variety of peculiar tics and mannerisms, and a very high degenerative myopia, requiring glasses so thick that their eyes seem distorted, giving them the appearance of absurd little professors, peering and pointing with a misplaced, obsessed, and absurd concentration. And this impression is fortified as soon as one quizzes them, or allows them, as they are apt to do, like pantomime puppets, to start spontaneously on one of their routines. This is the picture that has been presented in published articles, and on stage. They tend to be featured in the annual show in the hospital I work in, and in their not infrequent and rather embarrassing appearances on TV. The facts under these circumstances are established to monotony. The twins say, "Give us a date any time in the last or next 40,000 years." You give them a date, and almost instantly, they tell you what day of the week it would be. "Another date," they cry, and the performance is repeated. They will also tell you the date of Easter during the same period of 80,000 years. One may observe, though this is not usually mentioned in the reports, that their eyes move and fix in a peculiar way as they do this, as if they were unrolling or scrutinizing an inner landscape, a mental calendar. They have the look of seeing, of intense visualization, although it has been concluded that what is involved is pure calculation. Their memory for digits is remarkable and possibly unlimited. They will repeat a number of 3 digits, of 30 digits, of 300 digits with equal ease. This, too, has been attributed to a method. But when one comes to test their ability to calculate, the typical forte of arithmetical prodigies and mental calculators, they do astonishingly badly as their IQs of 60 might lead one to think. They cannot do simple addition or subtraction with any accuracy, and cannot even comprehend what multiplication or division means. What is this? Calculators who cannot calculate, and lack even the most rudimentary powers of arithmetic? And yet, they are called calendar calculators. And it has been inferred and accepted on next to no grounds that what is involved is not memory at all, but the use of an unconscious algorithm for calendar calculations. When one recollects how even Carl Friedrich Gauss, at once one of the greatest of mathematicians, and of calculators too, had the utmost difficulty in working out an algorithm for the date of Easter, it is scarcely credible that these twins, incapable of even the simplest arithmetical methods, could have inferred, worked out, and be using such an algorithm. A great many calculators, it is true, do have a large repertoire of methods and algorithms they have worked out for themselves, and perhaps this predisposed W.A. Horowitz and others to conclude this was true of the twins, too. Stephen Smith, taking these early studies at face value, comments, "Something mysterious, though commonplace, is operating here. The mysterious human ability to form unconscious algorithms on the basis of examples." If this were the beginning and end of it, they might indeed be seen as commonplace and not mysterious at all. For the computing of algorithms, which can be done well by machine, is essentially mechanical and comes into the spheres of problems but not mysteries. And yet, even in some of their performances, their tricks, there is a quality that takes one aback. They can tell one the weather and the events of any day in their lives, any day from about their 4th year on. Their way of talking, well conveyed by Robert Silverberg in his portrayal of the character Melangio, is at once childlike, detailed, without emotion. Give them a date, and their eyes roll for a moment, and then fixate, and in a flat, monotonous voice they tell you of the weather, the bare political events they would have heard of, and the events of their own lives, this last often including the painful or poignant anguish of childhood, the contempt, the jeers, the mortifications they endured, but all delivered in an even and unvarying tone, without the least hint of any personal inflection or emotion. Here clearly one is dealing with memories that seem of a documentary kind, in which there is no personal reference, no personal relation, no living center, whatever. It might be said that personal involvement, emotion, has been edited out of these memories, in the sort of defensive way one may observe in obsessive or schizoid types. And the twins must certainly be considered obsessive and schizoid. But it could be said equally, and indeed more plausibly, that memories of this kind never had any personal character. For this indeed is a cardinal characteristic of eidetic memory such as this. But what needs to be stressed, and this is insufficiently remarked on by their studiers, though perfectly obvious to a naive listener prepared to be amazed, is the magnitude of the twins' memory. It's apparently limitless, if childish and commonplace extent. And with this, the way in which memories are retrieved. And if you ask them how they can hold so much in their minds, a 300-figure digit, or the trillion events of 4 decades, they say very simply, we see it. And seeing, visualizing of extraordinary intensity, limitless range, and perfect fidelity seems to be the key to this. It seems a native physiological capacity of their minds, in a way which has some analogies to that of which A.R. Luria's famous patient, described in The Mind of a Mnemonist, saw, though perhaps the twins lack the rich synesthesia and conscious organization of the mnemonist's memories. But there is no doubt, in my mind at least, that there is available to the twins a prodigious panorama, a sort of landscape or physiognomy of all they have ever heard or seen or thought or done, and that in the blink of an eye, externally obvious as a brief rolling and fixation of the eyes, they are able, with the mind's eye, to retrieve and see nearly anything that lies in this vast landscape. Such powers of memory are most uncommon, but they are hardly unique. We know little or nothing about why the twins or anyone else have them. Is there then anything in the twins that is of deeper interest, as I have been hinting? I believe there is. It is recorded of Sir Herbert Oakley, the 19th century Edinburgh professor of music, that once taken to a farm, he heard a pig squeak and instantly cried G sharp. Someone ran to the piano and G sharp it was. My own first sight of the natural powers and natural mode of the twins came in a similar spontaneous and, I could not help feeling, rather comic manner. A box of matches on the table fell and discharged its contents on the floor. 111, they both cried simultaneously. And then, in a murmur, John said, 37. Michael repeated this. John said it a third time and stopped. I counted the matches. It took me some time. And there were 111. How could you count the matches so quickly? I asked.
We didn't count, they said. We saw the 111.
Similar tales are told of Zacharias Daze, the number prodigy, who would instantly call out 183 or 79 if a pile of peas was poured out, and indicate as best he could, he was also a dullard, that he did not count the peas, but just saw their number as a whole in a flash. And why did you murmur 37 and repeat it 3 times? I asked the twins. They said in unison, 37, 37, 37, 111. And this, if possible, I found even more puzzling. That they should see 111, 111-ness in a flash was extraordinary. But perhaps no more extraordinary than Oakley's G-sharp, a sort of absolute pitch, so to speak, for numbers. But they had then gone on to factor the number 111 without having any method, without even knowing in the ordinary way what factors meant. Had I not already observed
that they were incapable of the simplest calculations and didn't understand or seem to understand what multiplication or division was. Yet now, spontaneously, they had divided a compound number into three equal parts. "How did you work that out?" I said, rather hotly. They indicated, as best they could, in poor, insufficient terms, but perhaps there are no words to correspond to such things, that they did not work it out, but just saw it in a flash. John made a gesture with two outstretched fingers and his thumb, which seemed to suggest that they had spontaneously trisected the number, or that it came apart of its own accord into these three equal parts by a sort of spontaneous numerical fission. They seemed surprised at my surprise, as if I were somehow blind. And John's gesture conveyed an extraordinary sense of immediate felt reality. "Is it possible," I said to myself, "that they can somehow see the properties, not in a conceptual abstract way, but as qualities, felt, sensuous, in some immediate concrete way? And not simply isolated qualities, like 111-ness, but qualities of relationship? Perhaps in somewhat the same way as Sir Herbert Oakley might have said a third or a fifth. I had already come to feel, through their seeing events and dates, that they could hold in their minds, did hold, an immense mnemonic tapestry, a vast or possibly infinite landscape in which everything could be seen, either isolated or in relation. It was isolation rather than a sense of relation that was chiefly exhibited when they unfurled their implacable, haphazard documentary. But might not such prodigious powers of visualization, powers essentially concrete and quite distinct from conceptualization, might not such powers give them the potential of seeing relations, formal relations, relations of form, arbitrary or significant? If they could see 111-ness at a glance, if they could see an entire constellation of numbers, might they not also see at a glance, see, recognize, relate, and compare in an entirely sensual and non-intellectual way, enormously complex formations and constellations of numbers? A ridiculous, even disabling power. I thought of Borges's Funes. We, at one glance, can perceive three glasses on a table. Funes, all the leaves and tendrils and fruit that make up a grapevine. A circle drawn on a blackboard, a right angle, a lozenge, all these are forms we can fully and intuitively grasp. Irenaeus could do the same with the stormy mane of a pony, with a herd of cattle on a hill. I don't know how many stars he could see in the sky. Could the twins, who seemed to have a peculiar passion and grasp of numbers, could these twins, who had seen 111-ness at a glance, perhaps see in their minds a numerical vine with all the number leaves, number tendrils, number fruit that made it up? A strange, perhaps absurd, almost impossible thought, but what they had already shown me was so strange as to be almost beyond comprehension. And it was, for all I knew, the merest hint of what they might do. I thought about the matter, but it hardly bore thinking about. And then I forgot it, until a second spontaneous scene, a magical scene which I blundered into, completely by chance. This second time they were seated in a corner together, with a mysterious secret smile on their faces, a smile I had never seen before, enjoying the strange pleasure and peace they now seemed to have. I crept up quietly so as not to disturb them. They seemed to be locked in a singular, purely numerical converse. John would say a number, a six-figure number. Michael would catch the number, nod, smile, and seem to savor it. Then he, in turn, would say another six-figure number, and now it was John who received and appreciated it richly. They looked at first like two connoisseurs, wine tasting, sharing rare tastes, rare appreciations. I sat still, unseen by them, mesmerized, bewildered. What were they doing? What on earth was going on? I could make nothing of it. It was perhaps a sort of game, but it had a gravity and an intensity, a sort of serene and meditative and almost holy intensity, which I had never seen in any ordinary game before, and which I certainly had never seen before in the usually agitated and distracted twins. I contented myself with noting down the numbers they uttered, the numbers that manifestly gave them such delight, and which they contemplated, savored, shared in communion. Had the numbers any meaning, I wondered on the way home? Had they any real or universal sense, or, if any at all, a merely whimsical or private sense, like the secret and silly languages brothers and sisters sometimes work out for themselves? And as I drove home, I thought of Luria's twins, Leosha and Yura, brain-damaged, speech-damaged, identical twins, and how they would play and prattle with each other in a primitive, babble-like language of their own. John and Michael were not even using words or half-words, simply throwing numbers at each other. Were these Borgesian or Funesian numbers, mere numeric vines or pony manes or constellations, private number forms, a sort of number argot known to the twins alone? As soon as I got home, I pulled out tables of powers, factors, logarithms, and primes, mementos and relics of an odd, isolated period in my own childhood, when I too was something of a number brooder, a number seer, and had a peculiar passion for numbers. I already had a hunch, and now I confirmed it. All the numbers, the six-figure numbers, which the twins had exchanged were primes. That is, numbers that could be evenly divided by no other whole number than itself or one. Had they somehow seen or possessed such a book as mine? Or were they in some unimaginable way themselves seeing primes in somewhat the same way as they had seen 111-ness or 3337-ness? Certainly they could not be calculating them. They could calculate nothing. I returned to the ward the next day, carrying the precious book of primes with me. I again found them closeted in their numerical communion, but this time, without saying anything, I quietly joined them. They were taken aback at first, but when I made no interruption, they resumed their game of six-figure primes. After a few minutes, I decided to join in and ventured a number, an eight-figure prime. They both turned towards me, then suddenly became still, with a look of intense concentration and perhaps wonder on their faces. There was a long pause, the longest I had ever known them to make. It must have lasted a half minute or more. And then suddenly, simultaneously, they both broke into smiles. They had, after some unimaginable internal process of testing, suddenly seen my own eight-digit number as a prime. And this was manifestly a great joy, a double joy to them. First, because I had introduced a delightful new plaything, a prime of an order they had never previously encountered. And secondly, because it was evident that I had seen what they were doing, that I liked it, that I admired it, and that I could join in myself. They drew apart slightly, making room for me. A new number playmate, a third in their world. Then John, who always took the lead, thought for a very long time. It must have been at least 5 minutes, though I dared not move and scarcely breathed, and brought out a nine-figure number. And after a similar time, his twin, Michael, responded with a similar one. And then I, in my turn, after a surreptitious look in my book, added my own rather dishonest contribution, a ten-figure prime I found in my book. There was again, and for even longer, a wondering still silence, and then John, after a prodigious internal contemplation,
brought out a 12-figure number. I had no way of checking this and could not respond because my own book, which as far as I knew was unique of its kind, did not go beyond 10-figure primes. But Michael was up to it, though it took him 5 minutes, and an hour later the twins were swapping 20-figure primes. At least I assumed this was so, for I had no way of checking it. Nor was there an easy way in 1966, unless one had the use of a sophisticated computer. And even then, it would have been difficult. For whether one uses Eratosthenes' sieve or any other algorithm, there is no simple method of calculating primes. There is no simple method for primes of this order, and yet the twins were doing it. Again I thought of Daza, whom I had read of years before in F.W.H. Myers's enchanting 1903 book, Human Personality. We know that Daza, perhaps the most successful of such prodigies, was singularly devoid of mathematical grasp. Yet he, in 12 years, made tables of factors and prime numbers for the seventh and nearly the whole of the 8th million, a task which few men could have accomplished without mechanical aid in an ordinary lifetime. He may thus be ranked, Myers concludes, as the only man who has ever done valuable service to mathematics without being able to cross the Ass's Bridge. What is not made clear by Myers, and perhaps was not clear, is whether Daza had any method for the tables he made up, or whether, as hinted in his simple number-seeing experiments, he somehow saw these great primes as apparently the twins did. As I observed them quietly, this was easy to do because I had an office on the ward where the twins were housed, I observed them in countless other sorts of number games or number communion, the nature of which I could not ascertain or even guess at. But it seems likely or certain that they are dealing with real properties or qualities, for the arbitrary, such as random numbers, gives them no pleasure or scarcely any at all. It is clear that they must have sense in their numbers, in the same way, perhaps, as a musician must have harmony. Indeed, I find myself comparing them to musicians, or to Martin, also retarded, who found in the serene and magnificent architectonics of Bach a sensible manifestation of the ultimate harmony and order of the world, wholly inaccessible to him conceptually because of his intellectual limitations. Whoever is harmonically composed, writes Sir Thomas Browne, delights in harmony and a profound contemplation of the first composer. There is something in it of divinity more than the ear discovers. It is an hieroglyphical and shadowed lesson of the whole world, a sensible fit of that harmony which intellectually sounds in the ears of God. The soul is harmonical, and hath its nearest sympathy unto music. Richard Wolheim, in The Thread of Life, makes an absolute distinction between calculations and what he calls